One of the things I need to start with is I could tell you some ghastly stories about madness in Corinth and the Corinthians. But when I told my wife the stories, she said, please don't use those stories. Yet I think there's some things that really would help you to understand the Corinthians so that you will have a kind of sense of what's really going on in the ancient world. These stories are unfortunately true. They involve women, particularly the Dionysic cult. And the Dionysic cult was linked with the concept of the snakes, but not only dealing with that. Let me tell you one story, and I think that will give you a little bit of an understanding. Worshippers in Corinth honored the god Bacchus, or Dionysus. Dionysus was the god of wine and revelry, and the women devotees of Dionysus got drunk and engaged in frenzy nude dances. Does that begin to give you some idea of what happens? They participated in sexual prostitution, and when they were drunk, they acted like mad women. I'll tell you this much. Their activities had to do with an animal that they would have for sacrificial purposes, but they didn't kill the animal. They grabbed his flesh and ate it while the animal was still alive. And do you begin to get the picture? This was a very frenzied experience. And this became so, the Dionysic cult was so bad that the Roman Senate outlawed it. Now, if you understand the Roman Senate getting involved, then you understand how really bad it is, okay? Roman Senate, they didn't act like this, on making rules against religious patterns, unless they were really very bad. So one of the stories goes that a man was watching the women with their frenzied dancing, and they spotted him up in a tree watching them, and they tore him down, and then they used him as the sacrificial victim. So please understand that madness in the ancient world was regarded as something kind of spooky, okay? And people tended to honor people who were mad because they thought they had some special gift from God. So if you notice in the book, in the 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, when Paul starts talking about the women speaking in tongues, notice he says you'll think the visitors to that will think you're mad. Okay, if you begin to get that, you'll begin to see the background to what we're talking about. I think that most Americans, when they read this text, have no understanding of what madness is about. And that's part of the problem that we face in trying to interpret a text like this. You have to read the story, you have to read the ancient writers, and many of them. Cicero tells us about them, and all the others tell us about these mad women. So please understand, I'm not against women, and I don't think Paul is against women. He's against the incorrect way that some women are acting, okay? So he wants order, and so he doesn't want the women to be looked at as negative people. So I hope you understand that. It's very hard. Now, Paul is not against speaking in tongues. In fact, he says he does it more than they do. But he doesn't do it publicly. He does it privately, because he thinks that it's very important to be able to communicate the gospel. And the point of being of communicating the gospel is that he evaluates speaking in tongues. You know this. And if you're anti-charismatic, you probably are using this text. And that would mean that he evaluates speaking in tongues as 5 against 10,000. Well, that's not a very big percentage, right? So, because Paul is interested in the communication of the gospel and speaking, he wants them to be understood and communicating correctly. Now, I have never been against speaking in tongues. I've spoken in a lot of different places, including charismatic churches. And you know what they do? They usually ask me, do you speak in tongues when I speak, when I'm talking to them? And my answer usually is, wouldn't you like to know? You see, because the charismatics judge you by whether or not you can do that one thing. And I never answer that question, simply because I don't want them to judge either positively or negatively about me. But I suppose what you need to understand about speaking in tongues is that it is to put the person into neutral. A person speaks in neutral so that their mind is not working exactly with their mouth. And that's the very important thing for you to understand. It is kind of an experience that people have, that they really they don't know what they're saying. That's why Paul is constantly saying, if there's not an interpreter, then give up. And perhaps about the only amount of that you need to have is two of them are enough, probably, for Paul. And he would not prefer them to be in the church. That's basically Paul's perspective. But he does not deny the possibility of spiritual experiences. So let me give you an illustration that may help you. When I drive long distances, I usually start to sing my songs, sing songs. And I'll sing songs like this. What a friend we have in Jesus. 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 And my wife says, will you please finish that? You see, I'm not really thinking about what I'm saying when I'm saying that. I'm just enjoying Jesus. You see what I'm trying to say to you? That's what basically Paul is agreeing with. You can have these experiences of enjoying Jesus, and it doesn't matter. But please, it doesn't communicate. That's what he's saying. You see, that's what's kind of important. Now, the devil can get in the middle of this, and that's what he wants you to understand too, because the devil wants to manipulate any aspect of Christian witness to his advantage. And of course he's done that constantly because he's made people angry with each other. I remember talking with some missionaries in Latin America who said to me, you know, this fella doesn't speak in tongues and he wants to be a member of the charismatic group, and they won't accept him because he doesn't speak in tongues. So you see, what happens is this. People begin to say whether you're the in-group or in the out-group. And as soon as they start making groups, that's a divisive category. And that's very important to understand. Paul doesn't want groups. Paul wants people to be able to communicate about Jesus. So, what does this text mean? So I want to look at that text with you for a minute. In chapter 14, he goes on to say, "Brethren, if I come to you speaking in tongues," this is verse 6, "how shall I benefit you unless I bring you some revelation of knowledge or prophecy or teaching? If even lifeless instruments such as a flute or a harp do not give distinct notes, how will anyone know what is played?" So what he wants is distinction. When you're communicating, the important thing is making it clear. So his concern is about speaking in tongues. Is that clear? The answer is, if you speak in tongues and nobody understands you, you're speaking to the air. And you want to be able to communicate correctly. If you're speaking like in a foreign language and nobody knows what that means. Therefore, he who speaks in tongues should pray for the power to interpret. So if you got an interpreter, you know, and I've listened to people speaking in tongues, there's no question about it. It doesn't make too much sense. So that's okay. I've been close to a number of people in the American Bible Society, and the head of the Bible Society's interpretation pattern committee, and I talked about this at great length. He said, "We have done an analysis of various speaking in tongues, and there is no way to break it down into a language. Because what happens is it doesn't break down. It's just vague. It's babbling." And that's exactly what the ancient writers were saying. They're babbling. So I think that's kind of important for you to understand. Now, the text that's really tough. If you can all prophesy one by one, he wants them to be able to give a revelation and speak in a way that one speaks at one time. "For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace." Then comes a text. "As in all the churches of the saints, the woman should keep silence in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be subordinate, even as the law says. If there is anything they desire to know, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shameful thing for a woman to speak in church. And then, immediately after that, comes a statement. What? Did the word of God originate with you, or are you the only ones it has reached? If you notice a couple things about this text, which is the basis for all the arguments, you notice the first thing, what's the basis for condemning women speaking?
The law.
The law. When has Paul ever used the law as the basis for making a foundational statement?
He hasn't.
What's his basis for making statement?
Usually Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ. That's his basis for making any basic statement concerning the way in which we should live. That's correct. So what's going on here? I haven't shown you that all the way through 1 Corinthians, especially in the middle section, this is dialogical. If you go back, let me show you one place. If you go back with me for a minute to chapter 6, this used to be, there were no quotes around these statements. So the King James Version will have no quotes, but the recent translation has started to put quotes around it. You notice in verse 12 of chapter 6, all things are lawful for me is in quotes. But not all things are helpful. Who's saying what?
All things are lawful for the Corinthians saying, I can do it.
That, in other words, the Corinthians are saying all things are lawful, and Paul is answering, but not all things are helpful. Then he goes on, food is meant for the stomach and the stomach for food. Who's saying that?
The Corinthians.
The Corinthians. And Paul answers, and God will destroy them both. You see, this is very important to see the dialogue that's going on. Now, we didn't used to put quotes on this because everybody thought that this was all from Paul. But you'll see throughout that 1 Corinthians that there's a dialogue going on. This is an argument. So then and what comes a little later is, you know, why are the Corinthians arguing all things are lawful? And Paul is saying not all things are helpful. Food is meant for the stomach and the stomach for food. And God will destroy both of them. Why do you think they're saying this? It's because food is not the issue. Sex is. And so ultimately, the Corinthians want to have a foundation for having sex with prostitutes. And Paul is saying, do you see these Corinthians are not the greatest people in the world. Paul is saying, you can't argue that way, I'm not going to let you. You see, what he's saying is, okay, food is meant for the stomach and the stomach for food, and Paul is going to say, and God will judge you. So that takes away their argument. Well, I want you to think about this possibility. And the possibility is we haven't yet started putting quotes in other parts of 1 Corinthians. But who do you think is going to say the law says so? Paul?
No.
I don't think so. I think the one that's going to say the law is going to be the Corinthians. The law doesn't allow women to be anything, right? They were pushed down. And what Paul is saying is that's not the way it is. That's not the way it is. The way it is with God's. God's. You see, What we have to understand is Paul's already said that women could speak in this church as long as they're dressed right. You see this? So is he going to go now and say you can't speak for women? No, he's not going to say that. That's to be misunderstood. Well, I talked with Gordon Fee, who's probably the leading interpreter of the charismatic movement, the New Testament, the teacher. And I said to him, "What do you think about this text?" He said, "I don't think it's Pauline." I said, I think it's part of an argument. This is part of an argument against women. And I think the Corinthian men are now saying, these women are speaking in tongues, they're just like the Dionysic cult. And the Lord won't allow it. And I think Paul is saying, what? The law? What's they're doing with the law? The God? See, Paul is not going to say you can't speak in tongues. He's just going to say, do it decently and in order. You see, this is the point, I think, of the Corinthian context. Do it right. Do it the way you ought to do it. And don't start arguing about it. The Corinthians love to argue. And that this is very important to understand, because the Corinthians, you know, they're drunk. The men are drunk. But the men can get drunk, the women can't. You got it? This is the way we got to control the women. So, you know, I think we have to start thinking about how the Bible is read. And let's read the Bible the way it's written. Because I think part of our problem is that this is a real tough thing. Okay, there's this First Timothy text. So let's go there, because I think that's part of the argument constantly.
Dr. Borchardt, just to clarify my slow brain, where would you put the quotes? Just as your...
Well, I think they're saying that women can't just... They're not supposed to speak in tongues, but they're not even supposed to speak in church.
Like,
I think they want to silence the women. So and Paul has already said they could speak.
So you put in quotes around both those verses and together.
Yeah, I think that's... Gordon Fee said to me he doesn't think it belongs even in the text. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's very interesting is that we've got texts of 1 Corinthians that don't have it in. That's an interesting thing. So that, you know, I'm not going to take one side or the other. I just say it doesn't belong in Paul. It's not Pauline. It's not the way Paul talks. So if it's anything, it's the Corinthians talking. That's the way I look at it. Now, I go to 1 Timothy, because 1 Timothy is the real key to arguing. And I really don't know what to do with this. I have to tell you that, but I want you to see something here, because translators are not always truthful, okay? Let me just be honest with you on that. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, first of all, I urge that supplications and prayers and intercessions and thanksgiving be made for all people, kings and all who are in authority. High positions. He says all men, but then I'm saying all people, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life, godly and respectful in every way. Okay? Did you hear the word quiet? Everybody hear the word quiet? Now, some translators are starting to recognize that we've been unfaithful. But the word quiet and the word silence with respect to women is the same word. Why would you translate in the same context one way quiet and in another way silent? Do you think that's fair?
No.
Huh? I think that's a precondition. You have a presupposition that we ought to live a quiet life. And now we're going to translate the women that they should shut up. To me, that doesn't sound too good. Do you? So this is why I go now. You notice. So in verse 8, I desire that in every place men should pray, lifting up their hands without anger and quarreling. Also the women should adorn themselves modestly. Well, that seems to be reasonable. And sensibly, in seemly apparel, not with braided hair or gold or pearls and costly attire, but with deeds as benefits women who profess religion. Let the woman learn in silence. Why treat that as silence? When you we're talking about quiet life, aren't we? Well, now we've talked about women have to be silent. That's not very good. Now, I understand what Paul's trying to say. Why braided hair? When the women went to the hairdressers, it took about 4 hours to paint their hair. Now, we've got women who go to the hairdressers and they spend 5 hours. And Paul is saying, you don't need to do that. He said, I want you to just live a reasonable life. I am not against my wife getting her hairdressed, going to her hairdresser. I like that. But I'd rather see her dressed up properly than not, right?
Right.
That's fine. Okay. But now you look at what comes next. I permit no woman to teach or have authority over men. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became the transgressor. That sounds very Jewish. Is that Paul? I'm asking myself, that's a strange statement. But look at the next stuff that comes up. For Adam was first formed, and then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman, and was deceived and became. Yet a woman will be saved through childbearing. What the hang is that? Does that sound like Paul? Now, I know what some people do with this. They say, bearing a child. That's not what it says in the text. It says childbearing. Do you women think you're going to be saved through childbearing? What do you think the women's role was in the Jewish context? Childbearing. What do you think it is in Paul? What is Phoebe doing? She's representing Paul as his spokesman in Rome. This doesn't seem like it's Paul. Do you understand why many theologians and many biblical scholars say, this doesn't sound like Paul at all? Okay. Let me go to Romans for a minute. So Romans 16. I don't know whether this is helping you, but I want you to at least see it. Okay. Let's go to Romans 16. Boy, I fought with them on this one, the rest of the translation group. I won it on this one. I didn't win everything, but I won it on. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deaconess. This is the way it's usually translated. It's a female deacon. Is the deaconess different than a deacon?
No.
Well, in some Baptist churches, it's very different. I know that. I don't know whether it is with you, but I know that in Roman Catholic churches, A deaconess is different than a deacon. Think about this. Why do we have two different kinds of positions? A deaconess is a female deacon. But we've got different committees. A deaconess does all the work. A deacon makes judgments. See, this is crazy. She's a deaconess of the Church of Cancrea. I don't like this translation. I would just as soon say deacon. But you may receive. Now notice the next thing. Greet Priscilla and Aquila. Did you notice in my reading this morning that I said Priscilla and Aquila? Do you notice that Paul puts the woman first? Luke puts the man first. You need to understand the difference. In Acts, it's Aquila and Priscilla. In Paul, he knows what he's talking about. Now, let me go on. They have risked their lives, their necks for life, to whom not only I, but also the churches of the Gentiles give thanks. Greet my beloved Epaphras, who was the first convert in Asia. Greet Mary, who has worked hard among you. Greet Andronicus and Junius. I just tear out my hair when I read that text. What is Junius? That's a female name. And so many people have tried to tell me that Junius is a man's name. No. Why are they worried? Because of what comes next. My kinsman. This text says my kinsman. Crazy. My companions and my fellow prisoners, and now the translation is they are men of note among the apostles. There's no men there. You see, this is terrible translation. It's dishonest. Junius is our name for June. Is that a man's name?
Well, April and May aren't.
Well, you see, my translators have got troubles. They've got troubles. They have to be authentic people who the people read the text. They want to make sure that the Roman Catholics are like this text and so on like that. So they read. They write the way they want to write. And I'm saying, phooey. This is not being honest in translation. So remember that when you read a translation, it's somebody's opinion. Okay?
Yes.
It's somebody's opinion. It does not necessarily have to be true. I only want you to see examples. Because we read the way we want to read. And I've taught Greek for a long time. And a little Greek can be very dangerous. Okay. That doesn't work. So I have to tell you, God bless you all, people. I just think that it's time for me to just be honest about these things. And I think that God is really going to try to bless the church if the church is honest with his text. That's my feeling. I'm willing to accept the text the way it stands. What it means, I'll try to tell you. I'm not trying to tell you something that I don't believe. I really believe that this text, that Paul is not a male chauvinist pig. And some of my friends who are women do not like Paul at all. You know, that I read Paul differently than you do. And I'm telling you, I think this is a guy who, when you read him, you have to remember, he identifies himself as a nurse in First Thessalonians. What in the world? Do you think that Paul likes the Corinthians?
He loves them.
How many of you think Paul likes the Corinthians?
I think he wished he could like the Corinthians.
How many of you think he doesn't like the Corinthians? Well, I think I've started to manipulate you. But I will finish manipulating you by reading from 1 Thessalonians. So if you'll turn to 1 Thessalonians, I want you to get this. Now, these are the Macedonians. Paul has a different view of the Macedonians from the Achaeans, okay? The Achaeans are like this, you know? Their noses are in the air. They're the epitome of, they think they are the cat's meow. Okay, let's look at 1 Thessalonians for a minute. You know what kind of people we prove to be among you. This is the beginning of verse six. And you became imitators of us and of the Lord. And you received the word with much joy and glorification and so on like that. Inspired by the Holy Spirit. So that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and in Achaia. For not only has the word of the Lord sounded forth from you in Macedonia and Achaia, but your faith has gone forth everywhere, so that we need not say anything. For they themselves report concerning us what a welcome we had among you, and how you turned from God to God from idols, now to serve the living and true God, and to wait for the Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead. Now, I want you to look at something here. You turned from to God from idol, to serve the living and true God, and to wait for the Son from heaven. Do you see the triad? What are they doing? They're turning, they're serving, and they're waiting, right? What does that sound like to you? Faith, love, hope. Got it? See how those things are related? So you see what he's saying, is this the three aspects of salvation? For you yourselves know, brothers and sisters, that our visit to you was not in vain. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated in Philippi, and we know about that, as you know, we had courage in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in the face of great opposition. So, let's go on. Verse 7. But we were gentle among you like a
nurse.
Now, if Paul were a male chauvinist, do you think he'd choose nurse as his model? See, I just have to say, let's start reading Paul the way he is and not treat him as a male chauvinist. A nurse taking care of her children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were all ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also ourselves. I think this is very important. Not only does he look at himself as a nurse,
But he looks at himself as a father, too. Verse 11. For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to lead a life worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom. Paul is both sides. He's not one side or the other. So this is my text to you on 1 Corinthians. And I want us to start living the life that Paul wants us to live. It's not a set of rules. It's instructions for living.